Welcome to episode 8 of the Climate Champions podcast, and thank you to James Henry Bedell for the intro and outro music. I'm Lee Krivat, and each episode I talk to someone that is helping to mitigate climate change about what they are doing, why they are doing it, and their vision for the future. If you or someone you know is a climate champion and would like to be a guest on the podcast, please head to my website at www.krivatenergyinnovations.com and send me an email. My champion today is Sunil Sherian, CEO and founder of Spiray. Sunil and I met around 2010 when the SDG&E Smart Grid team was implementing a small demonstration microgrid. Spiray supplied the software that tied it all together. Since then, we've had many excellent conversations about the future of the energy system. Welcome to Climate Champions. It is the morning of DistribuTech. I believe it started a few hours ago with workshops and classes. I'm here with Sunil Sherian, the CEO and founder of Spiray. Can you please tell me about your first aha moment with regards to climate change, when you began to see it as something real and threatening and something that inspired you to do something?
I think I'll take two stabs at it.
Okay.
The first one is more along the lines of when I got excited about technologies that use renewable energy or renewable power, because I think that came before sort of a deeper recognition of climate change, which is probably in the last 10 years. So this goes back to sort of the first couple of years of my undergraduate in engineering. And one of the projects that we tried to do in my little group was to really use solar energy for air conditioning. So I grew up in India, I was doing my undergraduate there, and heating was not the issue, cooling was. And so, that experience, digging into that a little bit, writing a few papers, looking at the technologies then, the aha moment at that time was, we have so much energy and power coming at us for free. The problem is using it in the way you want it. So there the issue was, if you could actually cool, that was more interesting. And so, so at the time, that was a big deal for me and really got me thinking about this entire space. And as time went on, of course, you learn more and more about how energy is produced and used. And one of the things that kept on getting reinforced for myself was this idea that, punching a hole in the ground, sticking a straw in there and whatever comes out, burning it, seemed to be the most absurd thing to do. Right? So that was, and that has only continued to be reinforced over time. And now the scale of that is so massive. Today, we recognize that as a significant contributor to climate change. And from my perspective, there shouldn't be any surprises there. We consider the oil that we have or the fossil fuel resources as something planet Earth has in the bank, right? Just burning it is probably the worst thing that you can do,
It took hundreds and thousands of millions of years to put it there. We're just taking it out.
Exactly. And what is it? It's solar energy, right? It's just old sunlight. So today, when we think about climate change, there are, I don't know if I can point to one aha moment, but just the types of things that we've been facing recently is incredible. For me personally, just last year, when was it, October-November timeframe, there was a huge flood in my home state, Kerala, in India. My parents' house had 5.5 feet of water inside their house. My brother's house was completely flooded. In 100 years, nobody has seen a flood like this. Huge rains, at the wrong end of the season, actually. And, the fact of the matter is, it's not even considered when you look at a global scale. Events like that are happening everywhere, over and over again. And then when it hits home like that, you really think about it and say, what if this were to happen every 5 or 6 years, or you have events like this in the same place, all of the catastrophes that you're talking about impacts people at such a scale. We can differ, the debates about climate change, but I think it's in our face. And whether you're talking about glaciers in the Himalayas, there was an article this morning saying that it's disappearing. So I think those things, you know, putting these two things together, I think for me, it's just reinforced this this notion that we need to be very serious about climate change, and the fact that its consequences can be very, very fast. That's the scary part.
How do you explain climate change to people that don't understand it or don't see why it's something they should think they should do something about?
Well, I think, and again, I'm not a climate expert, right? So I cannot speak to the sort of the scientific foundation of some of these things as well. But if you look at all of the events that we talk about, a lot of people assume that climate change is like, you know, boiling a frog, right? Meaning, you know, it's the temperature slightly goes up and the consequences are incremental, right? So therefore, we can afford to ignore that for now, right? That's a very easy assumption to make. But the events that we are seeing are completely different. They're very nonlinear, like the, you know, deep freeze in Chicago, right? It just happens so fast, and having an 80 degree swing in temperature in a 24 hour period when you come out of it is incredible. You know, the flood that I was talking about happens so fast. So the triggers and I think these nonlinear effects that that you know create a step change very quickly. You know, you're really facing a situation like what was that movie a few years ago, The Day After Tomorrow or something. I think that was the one where you're having, you know, basically an ice age coming on us extremely rapidly. That's the kind of thing that really scares me, and why I think people should pay attention to stuff like this.
I think you're proving a point for me. You're somebody who's inspired to do something about climate change, but you're not an expert in the science that proves it to be so, that many scientists have done experiments to show what's going on. Instead, you are inspired by the events that are actually happening. That is how most people are and are going to be. The science behind it isn't going to be what inspires them. It's going to be having all these very negative weather-related events happening. And that's what's going to finally make enough people say, okay, this is enough. We really have to do something.
Absolutely.
Why is climate change mitigation personally important to you?
Well, that's an easy one.
Other than the flood. I got that one.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, you know, look at your kids. I think it's important because, well, I'll give you two extremes. You know, one is, as I said, when we think about our children and our grandchildren and whatnot. You know, I do believe that we need to do what we can do to leave a better place for them, as opposed to, you know, having clean up our mess, right? So that's one, I think, universal. I hope everybody feels that way. And even if you're erring on the wrong side, if you're erring in the spirit of that, I think you're doing the right thing. The other part of it is, you know, going to the other extreme, you know, we have so many, I don't know, what was that, the first photograph from the moon called, Earth Rising, right? Yeah, so you have a little blue marble in the blackness of space. It's the only home we've got. And I think it doesn't matter, you know, how narrow of a view you take or how far out you zoom out. The answer is the same. We have to do everything we can to actually leave a better place for the next generations. And for that, we have to act now.
I was in the audience when I think Colton Chang is his name from HECO. He's a senior vice president there. And he opened up his presentation. This was at UCLA at Dr. Gott's conference, by the way. If you ever have a chance, you want to go to one of those. And his first slide was a picture of Hawaii. All alone, kind of like you talked about the earth all alone in the middle of the ocean with nothing for hours, you know, for thousands of miles on either side. It was very impressive. And he said, this is why we need to figure this out. We are going to be impacted very soon.
Yeah. Well, there was an article that I read, I think just recently in the last week or so. It was about an island community in the Philippines. So there was basically some seismic activity over there of some sort. And one of these islands was basically sinking. It was actually, its elevation went down by a few feet or something like that. And essentially what it did was during high tides, this island started getting flooded. So you'd have the tides actually coming in. And so the government was trying to decide what to do with the community there. But the community did not want to move. They're, you know, based on the sea and they were fishermen. And, you know, they're adapting to that situation by, you know, raising the legs of their furniture or whatever to actually, you know. So you literally get water inside these small homes and whatnot. And the insight there in this article was that people are choosing not to move, but to adapt to that situation right there. They did not take up the offer to be relocated somewhere else. I think we're going to have this is the most extreme I've heard about to date, where you actually have a situation where these high tides are regularly flooding the place. So people are adapting. It's right here. And now when you talk about everybody talks about islands that are at risk, but every coastal area where the majority of human population lives is, a foot of water is going to make a huge impact.
And a lot of them don't have the means to get up and relocate and continue to have their livelihood.
Right.
Okay, tell me about Spray. What does Spray do? How's it going?
Well, what Spray does is relatively simple. We think that localizing energy is one of the ways to deal with all of these big issues we are talking about. Energy is not just a sort of a single source solution, right? To meet our energy needs, you need a portfolio, whether it's remote or whether it's local. If it's local, you have solar, you might have geothermal. You can have potentially gas-based energy sources. You can have storage on site. Nowadays, everybody is excited about electric vehicles. You could be charging your own transportation-related activities using your own local resource. So if you take those local resources, suddenly what you have is essentially a hybrid portfolio. It's got different generation, you've got storage, you've got load management capabilities. And by the way, you also have a grid you can tie to if it's available to you, right? And what Spray does is to take those diverse resources and basically be able to say, what's the software management technology to actually do the balancing act to optimize for something? It could be cost, it could be for minimizing carbon, it could be for resiliency. So the objective function can vary, but the software that binds it together is what we build. And the idea is that you need the ability to simply plug and play any of these resources or plug in any of these resources, tell it what to do, and the software should do the rest. That's it. So that's what Spray is all about.
And what led up to the forming of Spray? Did you do that right out of school or was there an in-between period?
Well, after I finished my PhD, I was doing a postdoc and a few of us decided that late 90s, we wanted a company too. Right, so that was before Spray. So I started a company at the time along with a few others. That was when California was first deregulating. So it was an exciting time at the time it was called Power Tech. And so that's when I, decided to jump in and become an entrepreneur and learned a lot of lessons through that experience. And then, of course, there were a lot of negatives around that time with the whole California debacle, Enron, 9/11.
I remember it well.
Unfortunately, right?
Yeah.
Right. So those hit a lot of turbulence then, and then that company was sold to another company at the time. And then I had to decide what I wanted to do personally. So that company was heavily venture financed and all that. And when I started Spray, I had learned a couple things. One, a lot more about what it actually means to be an entrepreneur and to really, to grow a company up from nothing, just a concept and, making it real. And then the other part was a lot of the dynamics in the energy industry itself, which I was not an expert in before that. So looking at those two things, I decided that a lot of these things, if you want to bring innovation here, it has to be bootstrapped and it was going to take time. So with Spray, the first several years was bootstrapping off of customer projects and whatnot, and we were lucky to win some very exciting projects at the time. So started Spray with the idea that bringing specific technologies to market in a narrower area that we were looking at was what I wanted to do, and then having more of a direct say in assembling these things, the generation, storage, loads, and then how does the software actually make that work? So developing the core technologies through customer-driven projects and then finding a way to actually productize it and scale it. That was essentially the inspiration behind Spiray and how I tried to get it off the ground.
You say tried. So that's a good lead-in to you talking about some of the setbacks or scary moments in your journey.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the life of an entrepreneur is, it's a pendulum that swings from one end, you know, excitement and a lot of action, and then, what looks like a disaster and edge of the cliff moments, right?
What were some really low ones?
I think if I just look back in the last 5 years, I think one of the low moments for me was, actually, I have to talk about the high before, right, in order to talk about the low. The high part of it was where there was a huge assumption in the industry that these technologies were going to be scaled through electric utilities. So there was an assumption that they have the resources, the capacity, the scale, and the reach. You're serving everybody, right? So the insertion of technologies at that through that as a channel can actually take solutions out to end consumers at a scale that nobody else can do. So I think there was, ever since the era of funding and whatnot and all of the activities around smart grids and everything that was coming, there was an assumption that that momentum was going to continue to go up. So I think we had actually invested a lot in that particular area. And essentially, that was one of our high points where we really, won some, fantastic customers, and we were really, we were in the process of swinging for the fence, right?
Yeah.
And then the downer that came was the fact that that momentum just stalled, right, for all kinds of reasons, policy reasons, regulatory reasons, business model issues and whatnot. And then what became clear was that the voice of the customer was pretty much lost in this supply side conversation. And I think that was a very painful recognition. And I think we had to make some course corrections because there wasn't enough activity going on for the companies that were in this space anyway. That course correction was incredibly painful. And we had to go through that in the last, about 2 years or so to essentially ask ourselves, how do you navigate in a situation where if the activity levels are pretty low not focused on ultimately who's the beneficiary of energy, that's the residential customers, commercial, industrial, whoever's the user of the energy is the beneficiary. So finding a model that actually takes solutions to them based on their differential needs. You cannot always construct solutions that are exactly the same for everybody you serve, right, which is the regulatory utility model, and you have to answer that a lot of times. But instead you say that one person wants 100% renewable source and the next person down the road from them wants the lowest cost energy. How do you serve them both? How can you do that? And that's where we had to make some tough choices. And I think we had to go through kind of a pretty low period as we made some of the corrections and then started working with channels that are taking solutions out globally in these areas to do that. So we went through a pretty tough phase figuring out that pivot and sort of acknowledging the fact that we had to do that, which is probably one of the toughest things I've had to do in recent years.
Okay, now I'll give you a chance to talk about your successes, because I know there have been a lot of them.
Well, that's true. Spiray has been lucky over the years to actually do a lot of very exciting projects, what would be considered sort of these showcase projects. Early on, one of the big projects and one of the biggest ones we have done to date was in Denmark. We did a project called the Cell Controller Project. It was championed by the TSO there, Energinet.dk, and an electric utility called Sydenergi. Right? So they were essentially doing a project to actually combine wind power, district heating systems, grid operations, and really do what are now called utility scale microgrids. In the late 2000s.
Right? I was going to say, this was a number of years ago, because when I talked to you, you were in the midst of that project.
Right. And that was, from a technology perspective, that is very exciting, because we were actually able to prove that you can put systems like this together, separate completely from the transmission system, run with local resources at massive scale. Right? So the communities we were talking about, there are three towns that are over, if I remember correctly, 26,000 or so customer meters in that area that we were able to run using local resources. So that project was designed to actually prove that these technologies could actually function as desired, so they could move forward with the policies that Denmark was trying to put in place to go to 100% renewables and all that. So that was very exciting and a big win for a small company, and for us to complete that project was very, very exciting. Later on, I think the successes were more on winning the right types of customers and working through them to actually deliver solutions at scale. So, some of the utility successes, one, as you know, us working with San Diego Gas and Electric to actually do their, Borrego microgrid project to actually run that on our Wave software.
I know, but I left before it was over, never got to really see it go.
Well, there you go. So that's the Borrego Springs microgrid is actually running on our software. And then, of course, a lot of the storage technologies are actually coming in. It's still a moving target there, though, because of the ways in which utilities have to manage those systems are different from what I'm now talking about. How do you turn on, whether it's a 100 kilowatt system or a couple of megawatt system, just nodal systems that can be clicked on very quickly. So just very quickly, one of the successes for us was now when we deploy one of these sites, whether it's a few hundred kilowatts or a low megawatt size system, you only have very little time to design, configure, commission, operate. All of that in a matter of weeks. When you go out to commission a site, you get 3 or 4 days, and you got to walk in, commission the site, leave it operational, and walk away. And now it's running 24/7. That for me was an incredible win on multiple levels. Technology, of course, but the business model that it's actually supporting, to say that now you're not talking endlessly about designing some newfangled thing. It's considered mature. You got to go in, you got to turn it on, and it's all commercially operational on the other side. That is, I think, a huge defining moment for us.
So you are trying to get rid of the saying, when you've seen one microgrid, you've seen one microgrid, right?
Exactly. Yeah. That is absolutely the case. And if you cannot turn on these systems nodally, just like your cable company comes and turns on a cable service for you at a location, that means a node has been turned on, and now there's delivery of different types of channels or whatever it is that you want to buy at that location. But we all complain about the cable company, but they'll give you a 4-hour window, we want a 1-hour window. But they come in, you turn it on, and you're done, right? That's exactly what needs to occur with energy. And when you have these types of hybrid systems, when you can do that, you have two things. You have delivery infrastructure, and you have the nodal technologies to actually use it optimally. Those are the two things that have to come together. And at that point, this industry will no longer look the same.
I think it was about 6 to 8 years ago. I'm sorry, I don't remember exactly when. You and I were in a conference room, and we were discussing that in the future, each circuit of a utility coming out of the substation would be a microgrid, that you would be able to control what was on it. And if you had to, you'd be able to separate from the rest of the grid if there were issues, because we believe there'd be enough distributed energy resources along many of the circuits to do that with. I don't know if you recall that conversation.
I don't know which event you're talking about, but of course I remember multiple conversations on exactly that topic with you.
But now you're not going in that direction.
Well, if you look at our primary customers, I think that is the case. We do go in that direction, but with the other partners that understand sort of the operational and integration challenges of electric utilities a heck of a lot better than us. So that's how we're actually getting there. So, and in fact, we have channel partners that are pursuing opportunities, just like the ones that you talked about.
Yeah.
So that's just the go-to-market part. But the more interesting part, I think, in your question is, how will the grid be operated in the future?
Right? That was my very next question. What is your vision?
Okay.
That's still my vision, actually, for how the larger grid will be operated as microgrids, but not getting rid of the grid of today. But what is your vision of the future?
I think my vision is very similar to that. Right? So today, the management of that type of a system is very much viewed as a top-down model. Right? Top-down in the sense that there are people in a distribution operations center that should keep track of all of the stuff, run load flows and do this, that, and the other. That's the entrenched view, and I don't think alternatives to that are very easily found. People just assume that that's how you run the grid. What I'm talking about and where things are going with the distributed energy, people were trying to find a middle road, just as you were saying, can I take a feeder and can I do something with that and essentially adapt or extend the currently used technologies to actually get there. What's happening is that if you look at the cost of solar, of inverters, of storage, of electric vehicles, those costs are dropping so fast, you will get to that point where the end user will take charge of their infrastructure themselves. So at that point, there's a huge difference in what will happen. Control will shift from the top-down view of the grid to the bottom-up view, where the end users use the grid as an optional piece. Spiray software or somebody else's software will sit there and optimize for that customer regardless of what the utility does. You change your utility rate structure, the software will automatically respond. You won't even have a second to take advantage of the modified rates that are actually put in from the other side.
But that means the utility needs to put in tariffs that incent behavior that they really, really need. Otherwise, the cost of that grid is going to be very high.
Exactly. But so what that means is you have to incentivize the right behavior, because you lose sort of the ability to dictate to the customer what to do, or use punitive rates to actually keep people from doing something you don't want them to do. But instead, it's about doing something because you want to do it. Right? Now, if you look at the grid operations and you say, what should I do about renewables penetration on a feeder or DER or storage or whatever, I think it's just asking the wrong question anymore. That was a very good question 10 or 15 years ago. That ship has sailed. This is just my opinion, right? Now the question is about service delivery to those end nodes. So how do you sign a contract with an end customer that's interested in A, B, or C? They want 100% renewables, or they want lowest cost power, or they want to maximize the value of their battery storage unit by participating in markets, or whatever it is that they want to do. The model for an electric utility has to shift from moving electrons from one point to another to saying, how do I enable or facilitate these energy services? That's what needs to occur. And that infrastructure has, yes, the copper is important, but that's not where the battles will be as we go forward, I don't believe.
I think the tricky part of all this is regulations and legislation, and where does that push end users as well as utilities, because they can't control those directions to some extent.
That's true. And I think that's where, when you look at the timeline for this change, all of these major stakeholders have to sort of do their dance and land somewhere. And that's where it's a slow process. And I think from an entrepreneur's perspective, very often frustrating.
I didn't want to set you up to say something bad about regulators. Not my intention. Do you have any questions for me?
Of course I do.
Oh.
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to your podcast.
Oh, my pleasure.
So excited about it. Now you have interviewed several people, and so I'm curious about the types of takeaways that you're picking up, especially when it comes to climate change.
Well, what's interesting to me is that most people are not experts in the science, although they're dedicating their work lives, and maybe more than that, to solutions that will help mitigate climate change, that they're more acting based on a feeling that it's obvious that things are changing, and that taking oil and gas out of the ground and burning it is going to bring ill effects. So that seems to be more of an obvious thing to people. And then the weather events we're seeing seem to be the sign that those obvious things you could have figured out are now happening based on it, as opposed to the science. Except with one exception, there are these two co-founders of a company called Pi Energy that I talked to, and they have all the science. So that's been interesting. I thought people would know more about the science part, but that's actually the minority.
I think that's great, because I think we need more storytellers.
Yeah. more. Hopefully not more floods.
Yeah.
And more fires, you know, but that's where the stories are coming from right now. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about?
Well, I think we covered a lot of ground. One thing to touch on, when we talk about hybrid energy and whatnot, and we debate the changes that are happening in the electric utility space since we are here at this Distribute Tech event, people forget that a lot of the energy battles are elsewhere, right? There are a couple of billion people without access to any type of electricity. So these types of solutions, when you talk about innovation and where this will all go, it's happening right here, right now, around the world, with a lot of communities, a lot of people doing their very best to bootstrap yesterday's grid. And it will happen, I think, in the next, probably 10 to 15 years, where you're going to see innovation coming in from somewhere else.
Well, it was Ted Craver that said, 10 years ago, he said, in the next 10 years, the grid will change more than the last 100. But what you're saying, and what I agree with, is that the next 10 will make this 10 look like we were just getting started. Because
exactly.
It is getting more intense.
And in fact, you may not see much change on the grid. You'll see change around it, where the grid is not the answer. The answer will be something else.
Yeah, I shouldn't have even said grid. The energy industry.
Energy system, yeah.
Yeah, is already changing considerably, and that pace is only picking up.
Exactly.
Is it okay if I wrap it up?
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm going to wrap it up with a wrap. The solar heat in India, it comes for free, but you need electricity to make it AC. The fuel in the ground coming up. It's only common sense that the catastrophic things happening are the events that will make people see that they have to rearrange, that it's time for the energy grid to change. What is a microgrid might be subjective, but you're making a plug and play to meet any objective. The catastrophes are igniting some of your fears, especially when they're personal, like floods that haven't happened for 100 years. Working with utilities can be really tense. You went after it anyway because you were swinging for the fence. Different microgrids, they're of different kind of breeds, but now you're focusing on more plug-and-play ones to solve customer needs.
Well, I was hoping for energy storytellers, and we have an energy rapper right here.
Kind of.
All right. Thank you, Lee.
Putting the extremely offbeat rap, if you could call it that, aside, if you're enjoying the Climate Champions podcast series, please subscribe, rate it 5 stars, and tell your climate-concerned friends about it. Also, if you have any questions or comments, my website is www.crivatenergyinnovations.com. I would love to hear from you via email. Sunil's work to standardize and modularize microgrids is a critical step to build a grid based on a federated network of microgrids capable of integrating the high percentage of carbon-free energy necessary to mitigate climate change.